This podcast was recorded on the lands of the Boon Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation, the land on which we're lucky enough to raise our sons and daughters. Always was and always will be Aboriginal land. This episode of Ready or Not is brought to you by Bon Soiree, because kids' bedding should be as stylish as the rest of your home. They create timeless, beautiful bed linen that grows with your child, blending classic design with playful touches. Think of it like an investment piece for their bedroom, something that evolves with them, just like their little personalities. If you love the idea of making bedtime that little bit more special, check them out at bonsoiree.com.au.
Sarah Tarker's decision not to send her kids to childcare has nothing to do with me and my choice to send mine. And yet, of all the choices she's made in her parenting life, this is the one that's the most divisive. The one that compels people to voice their opinion the loudest. She's not holding up childcare is bad signs. She's not telling others not to do it. Simply, it just wasn't part of her plan. And after listening to her talk about it, I'm fairly convinced that we can all get a little bit better at finding confidence in our own choices rather than judging someone else's. Prior to motherhood, she cut her teeth at the likes of Cosmo and Girlfriend before building a freelance career that would allow her to travel and work around the world. In fact, she was on a plane to Brazil to attend none other than Carnival when she got the call to confirm that she was in fact pregnant. Here, she talks about the identity loss that came with leaving her corporate career behind, what she learned from how Mia Friedman made work work as a young mum in the media world, how starting her family later than the norm led her to be able to create the flexible work schedule she wanted, and why childcare wasn't part of the plan for her family. I'm Lucinda. This is Ready or Not. And here is the reflective and radiant Sarah Tarker. And just a note that luckily we've finished talking at this point, but there's some sort of weird glitchy noise that comes up just as the outro starts playing. Done is better than perfect. I'm too tired to change it. I've got both kids home. We're doing the best we can today. Sarah, you chose not to send your children to childcare with a very unjudgmental tone, or non-judgmental tone, I'd say. It wasn't an anti-daycare thing. It was just your choice. And in your unique situation, that's what worked. But what surprised you was how divisive that was, perhaps the most divisive thing you've worked through in your motherhood career trajectory. Can you tell us a bit about how that sort of started, what you noticed, and then what it was like dealing with that and dealing with future conversations?
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting because it's just not something that I expected to hit a raw nerve with people, because it's something that is just obviously so personal to every family situation. For us, I'm a creative and my partner is also a creative and we both work from home. And it didn't make financial sense. That's number one, because we would literally be taking on work just to pay for childcare when between us, we felt that we could juggle it ourselves. So that's kind of the reasoning behind it. And the other reasoning was really just that we had kids a little bit later than other people. I was 37 and 39. And I think I was just ready to spend time with my kids. And I'd sort of, you know, I'd already been freelance for years and I'd really worked on creating a flexible working environment in the lead up to having kids. And that was also designed so that we could spend time with them. And also it didn't make financial sense. But then, you know, in sharing that with other people, what was really interesting is that I listened to obviously friends and family, and, you know, they'll talk about the struggle of like daycare pickups and illnesses and all of that type of thing. And you listen as and share that experience as a mother. But if I happen to say, oh, you know, it's been really hard at the moment because I've got a lot of work on and I'm working till, you know, midnight or whatever, you know, the baby's waking all the time, the answer was always like, should you put them in daycare? Maybe you should put them in daycare. Maybe just one day a week. It'll be really good for them. It'll be really good for them socially and everything. And that's fine if that works for you. Absolutely. But we just didn't need to. And I just didn't understand why it was the knee jerk to me having my little mum whinge about things being hard that they had to automatically be like, oh, you know, you should review that choice that you made about your, the way that you do your life. And certainly I didn't say every time a friend said, oh, you know, we've got another daycare illness, maybe you should just have them at home with you the whole time. So that's what really shocked me as well, is that, yeah, it's not like I was out there sort of promoting my way of life as the right way, but it seemed to be that the opposite was true.
Do you feel that that was a really glaring example for the way we try and, I guess, always respond with fixing? I'm thinking about things like when I'd say motherhood was hard and people would be like, well, you're doing X, Y, and Z. You're so busy. Of course you're tired and finding things hard. And in those moments, I think, I don't want you to tell me that. I don't want you to make me feel bad about taking on too much. These are the choices I have made for my life. I just want you to listen to me and hear me. Did that feel like it represented a very common experience we go through with motherhood?
Yeah, I definitely think that there was a little bit of that. But I also think that the mothers are carrying like a base level of guilt about their decisions anyway. And I think responses like that are more like, yeah, like, a, you know, like the sort of their inner guilt speaking, like, oh, you know, I wish I could spend more time with my kids, or I wish I didn't have to send them to daycare, or maybe I should be doing that, or maybe she's judging me because I don't send my kids to daycare. I'm not sure. I think it was kind of a bit of both. And, you know, I think when somebody does something in parenting in a different way to us, I think that people just find it really confronting. And, you know, if you're doing a similar thing to most people, it's like a way easier sort of path to follow than if you're doing it in a different way. I think that that becomes sort of confronting in itself.
You also mentioned something really interesting, which is that you started your family at 37. So I would say on average you had, if we're painting sort of a very broad stroke, about 5 extra years in your career than, let's say, what is probably average. I'm guessing, I think it's around 32 is the average age to start your family. Do you think there's something in that you were able to set yourself up from a career sense for longer that allowed you that extra flexibility? I'm thinking about the fact that most people are in the absolute trenches of their career just when they start their motherhood journey. So childcare almost feels like the only option, whereas you had that extra time to pave the way for yourself.
Yeah. And I think, you know, having a media career, a lot of people in media actually, I think, start their families 35. And this is just anecdotal. This is just from the people that sort of I know around me. We're sort of focused on having our career first. And it was like a goal to where we wanted to be. And then after that, we were like, oh, okay, now I'm ready for a family. But it absolutely set me up for having a family in that way, because I was really ready. I think that I didn't feel like I was missing out. I'm someone who gets terrible FOMO, regardless. I get such bad FOMO, but I really didn't. You know, I'd gotten to where I wanted to be in a working environment. I was editor for 5 years, and I, you know, that had been my goal for so long. And so when I stepped out of magazines and went freelance, I was kind of, you know, fine not being in that life anymore. And I think then having the kids, I was ready to be in that new life, if that makes sense. I wasn't sort of looking, you know, or I wasn't seeing jobs come up and having that pang of like, oh, well, I wish I could have gone for that. I was really just ready to sort of pause that part of my life, or even leave it behind and step into the new role of motherhood.
Which is such a nice timeline when you put it like that. So for anyone that's having babies in more the mid to late 30s or even early 40s, I think that's a really nice thing to touch on. Let's take it back now. We've touched on your career. I want to go deeper. You finished school. What takes you from there to motherhood in terms of your career? Just a little bit of a pocket of time to look at.
We'll just condense love 25 years. So I'm from Adelaide, and I grew up in the country, moved to Adelaide when I was 14. And I'd always wanted to be a journalist, and I wanted to be a writer. And I thought at the time, oh, you know, I'm going to take the smart career move and not be an author and be a journalist instead. Look where that's got me in the current industry. So that's the path I chose. And straight out of school, I did journalism at university. And when I was in my second year, I cold called some magazines in Sydney and saw if they did work experience. And I packed myself off to Sydney for 3 weeks and did work experience at a few magazines and decided that that was where I wanted to be. So I ended up getting an internship at Cosmopolitan and moving at 21 over to Sydney for an unpaid internship and working in a shoe store to sort of pay the bills in Sydney. And I was just really lucky that 4 months later, a job came up and the job was mine. So I started off there. I started off as Mia Freedman's assistant.
What was that like, just quickly?
I mean, it was incredible. It was like, what a way to learn. It was, you know, Cosmo at the time as well was like the magazine, you know, it was the one, you know, this is 2001. It was like the magazine that everyone read and it was really at its height. And Mia was an incredible force and taught me a lot. It was definitely a, you know, take the country girl out of Adelaide and throw her into the pit of fire and see what she can do. But it was, you know, I learned so much. And I think a lot of what I took in my, you know, have taken into my later career was the learnings from those early days at Cosmo. Like, it's amazing. Like, being a PA is actually the most incredible start to a career because you really learn the importance of interpersonal relationships and connections with people. And, you know, that's how you get things done. Like, you know, I started off not knowing really Sydney at all. And by the end, you know, I had like the tailor on speed dial. I knew where to fix a broken heel. You know, I knew which guys in the mailroom could do me a favor to get my mail done so like sooner. And it really did well for like building those interpersonal relationships, which I have needed consistently throughout my career. So yeah, it was a really great way to learn.
Interestingly, that must have been when Mia Freedman was in the thick of having her family.
Yeah.
Did you notice anything about motherhood and career juggling then? And if you didn't, do you think it was more that she was hiding it because that was the times, or that you just didn't notice because you were a young woman cutting your teeth in the industry?
No, she already had. So she had her first son, Luca, then, and she didn't have the girls yet. So, and no, Mia definitely never hid that part of her life. And not only that, she always prioritized her family. And, you know, I think I learned a lot from that. And she, because she also was very, very good at sort of helping us prioritize our family. And we learned from that as well. So, you know, that there was always, it was always very clear that was really important to her. And it was kind of nice because that was, you know, there was this boss side and there was also this really human side of being a mom. And, you know, and she was really young, like, you know, when she fell pregnant, it was right at the start of her career as an editor as well. So I think if anything, it sort of showed that you could do both. And that you could have both and it wasn't one or the other. Yeah.
That is really nice to know because I would have expected that about 20, 25 years ago, it might have been more that you have to hide this part of yourself at work. So I'm glad that it wasn't. What happens next? What takes you to becoming an editor?
All right. Yeah. So I was at Cosmo for 3.5 years and I sort of worked myself up to my way up to being in a writer position. And then I moved across to Pacific Mags as to Girlfriend Magazine. And that was my first foray into beauty. So I was a beauty editor there for 4 years. I was beauty editor and then beauty and lifestyle editor. And then I became editor after that. And so I was at Girlfriend for a total of 9 years. I absolutely loved working in teen. It was just a really fun time. I feel like it reverses your age to work in teen. But there is also a real optimism in teen that you don't have in sort of other lifestyle titles as well. There is, you know, teens are experiencing things for the first time with fresh eyes and fresh enthusiasm and they're not jaded. And I just loved that. And I loved, you know, I always said that I was a big sister to, you know, 300,000 teenage girls for 9 years. And
oh, I'm jealous.
Yeah. Like, and like, I mean, as a writer, that's also a huge responsibility as well. So it made me really accountable, because, you know, when you're writing for your own age group, you're like, oh, you know, they're adults and they can kind of see it for themselves if they, you know, take it or leave it, depending on your own sort of personal preferences. But with teens, I felt really felt the weight of like, no, they're taking this as gospel. And so I've got to get it right. And I've got to have the responsibility. It was one I took really seriously. And yeah, and I absolutely loved it. So after that, I did a stint at Marie Claire and back on the beauty team. I was beauty director there just before I stepped out of magazines altogether and packed it all in and was like a vagabond for 6 years. No fixed address.
Wow. So was 6 years the period of when you left that role and before you started Gloss, et cetera? Is that that period of time?
Yeah, it was, well, it was sort of all sort of mixed in together. So I left Sydney, my partner and I left Sydney, and we decided to go traveling. So I was 35 at the time, and we were sort of done with, I guess, that like done with that life, I would say. It was more that, you know, we were working really, really hard doing, you know, the career Sydney thing. We were super burnt out. We basically didn't see each other at all.
Yeah, you would have done a lot of socializing in your work.
Yeah, and it was just, I guess, not healthy after a while. Like, it was just this constant cycle of like of work, 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 and being on all the time. It was also the time in print media, like that sort of period where things started to change as well. And, you know, during that time, it was like Instagram blew up and, you know, and all these other things. And then, like, so obviously magazine sales started to drop. And suddenly, you know, like at the beginning, I was hired to be an editor. And by the end, I was the social media director and editor and, you know, a million other different things, videographer that I sort of hadn't signed up to be, but had just evolved. Like, and, you know, that's, I think that's a thing about creatives now. Like, you know, you can start off in one thing, but, you know, with the way that the world is, you end up taking on so many different hats and so many different iterations of your career that you kind of didn't expect. And we've had to be really flexible and we've had to just adapt as it keeps going. But that was, you know, it started off as kind of one job down this line and ended up being this, you know, huge sort of monster. And it just meant that I was always connected. I was always on my phone. I was always, you know, and I think my personal relationships really suffered from that as well. So we packed up everything, we sold everything we owned, and we put it into a go-get van. We drove it down to Melbourne and put it into my partner's childhood bedroom, and we went overseas.
Where did you go and did you work at all? I need to hear about this before we move on.
So that was always the plan, I guess. The upside of being a writer is that I can do it wherever I have my laptop. So, and my partner also works with his computer, he works in digital marketing, so he could do the same thing. So we knew that wherever we went, as long as we had our computers, we could work and we were hireable. And that's exactly what we did. I started off freelancing for a bunch of different people in Australia and overseas in different titles. I did some, you know, did some copywriting. I still do copywriting. We did some digital, we had some digital marketing clients together. And yeah, and that's, we just sort of would travel. We went to Europe. We traveled on and off through Europe. We'd come back to Australia sort of every, you know, 3 to 6 months and sort of recalibrate and then for a month, and then we'd sort of go back over again. And we did that for two years. And then I fell pregnant with Yuki. And I mean, it was amazing. It was so, we found out we were pregnant with Yuki. We'd booked in to go to Brazil for Carnival.
And of all places.
The week before he left. In fact, it was like we'd had the blood test and I called the doctor when we were on the plane ready to sort of take off to just confirm the results. And he was like, yep, you're pregnant. And I was like, cool, I've got 24 hours to think about how I'm going to be sober for all of Carnival. So yeah, I actually ended up doing 6 months, 6.5 months of my pregnancy overseas. Yeah. And coming back, and then we were sort of, we had him in Australia. And then when he was 7 months, we took him with us. did it all again. And we sort of followed that pattern until COVID, and that grounded us for a little bit.
So you had very clearly ticked the sort of career goals and those pre-kid goals, which I'm pretty insanely jealous of. That sounds amazing. What are your feelings of motherhood when you're on those trips? I'm imagining starting to toil with the idea of starting your own family. Mm. How do you feel about it before you actually fall pregnant?
Look, kids were something that I always wanted. I always knew that it was part of what my life would be, and is always something that I wanted. It was so silly. I think, like a lot of people, I was kind of waiting for this like light bulb moment where I'm like, yes, now I'm ready. And, you know, it's like people who are just waiting to fall head over heels in love, or like to find the moment or the spot. I just never got it. I just never had this light bulb moment. And I found it hard to reconcile the fact that like I was waiting for this, but I also knew I wanted it. And I was like, will I ever feel ready? And I think because the idea is a little bit scary, I just like never felt ready. And then my personality is very much like, you know, kind of like rip the Band-Aid off. And I think I was just like, look, I'm better just dealing with the situation when I have it. So I think I just need to be pregnant and then deal with it. Not overthink it, because I don't want a long time to overthink it. And that was kind of it. So that's kind of like how it happened. We sort of had decided, I mean, we didn't really plan. That was kind of the way that we went about it. And that was totally like rang true that when I was pregnant, I was just like, oh, okay, well, we'd already planned all this stuff, but I'm not going to let it stop me. I'm just going to keep going on. And yeah, I think I'm just better at dealing with it and not overthinking it like that. So I definitely did want kids, and I definitely knew it was part of my plan. And I think it just sort of happened when we were ready. When I think about if I could have had kids in the life I had in Sydney, I don't think that there was room in my life, like spiritual room, emotional room, for me to have that. I just don't know how that would have worked. So, you know, like, I know it sounds a bit woo-woo, but like sort of taking a step back and looking at it, I'm like, it sort of came at a time when I was emotionally and I guess ready to have the space in my life for a kid. And yeah, that's what happened.
What an incredible journey. So you're pregnant, you're traveling, you're planning your return home. Talk us through getting back to Australian shores and starting to think about what parental leave might look like, if there's such a thing for a freelancer, how all of that sort of looked for you.
So we had talked about a lot, you know, about what we would do as a family and, you know, sort of how we would work, I guess, the two of us being freelance. And I think it was just, honestly, it was just a real sort of patchwork job. We got the government 12 weeks or whatever that is, but of course there's no parental leave. So what we tried to do with clients is just work ahead and let them know in advance. And they were all very understanding, obviously, that we were going to be taking a little bit of time. But in all honesty, I was back at work probably within the first few weeks of Yuki being born. But that said, it's not like I was sitting at a desk every day and like I was working when he napped and I was working, you know. And so it didn't really feel very big at the time because, you know, he was sleeping a lot and I sort of had the capacity and the flexibility. So no parental leave, but we just have kind of patchworked it together to sort of give each other the time we needed to do the work, and then we just tag teamed.
You mentioned something that rings true, I think, for a lot of mums. And I actually remember Justine Cullen saying that on this show, that we almost, a lot of us, not everyone, but some of us find that newborn phase almost easier to do a little bit of work, and it's almost later that it becomes more challenging when they demand more from us. What did that look like for you if we look to sort of that 6 to 12 month mark when Yuki started to become a bit more of a person, I guess? How did making work start to look then, and how did you and your partner start to divide and conquer?
Yeah, there's absolutely, like, it was definitely harder when it was when he demanded a bit more. And like, and I guess the other thing, you know, is that I was breastfeeding. So obviously you can divide up to a point, but then there's still, he was obviously needing me and my body more. So that was a, sort of a bit more challenging. But, you know, I think one thing about sort of, I guess, being freelance is that that's, I guess, cohesive with motherhood, is that you're used to the ebbs and flows. You're used to changing things around a lot. You're used to sort of the flexibility of working like this, and then, oh, next week it could be like that. And so it kind of set me up for being flexible and just getting it done when I could get it done. And that's really sort of how we worked for such a long time. If I'm really honest, I'm like, my consistent work hours are 7 till 9 every single night.
And still to this day?
Still to this day, yeah. Because my youngest isn't in school yet. But, you know, I feel like it's a season, right? Everything's a season. It's like every phase of motherhood is a season. And I've always sort of looked at that and gone, this is what it is for now, but it is also not that forever. So, of course, it's not sustainable, but I also know that it won't be like this. And that's the thing about that flexibility, is like I kind of set myself up to being like, oh, you know, it looks like this today, or it looks like this, you know, this week, but that won't always be like this. And I kind of, thinking like that takes the weight off my shoulders a bit. So yeah. I'm not just getting like, oh, you know, it's so hard. And so, yeah, of course it's hard, but it's like, it's not always going to be like this.
Sometimes I feel like that boundary talk and self-care sometimes almost sets me up to feel bad in those busy times when I am just getting the work done. I am working late. I often do what you do, pull the laptop out once the kids are in bed. Do you think there's a sense of that, that almost we talk so much about self-care and burnout these days, that it doesn't almost honor the way the world works sometimes and what we sometimes just have to do in order to find joy in other ways, which for you is perhaps being with your child during the day and then just clocking on at night?
Yeah, I absolutely, like, I 100% agree with that. These are all choices that we make. They're all little choices that we make to make up, you know, our sort of our bigger life. And for me, that is what I do so that I can afford other things in my life. And it's not that big a deal for me in the end. Like I said, it's, you know, it is tiring to take your laptop out after a full day of mothering, but it's also like next year, Mika will be in school and that will look different again. And suddenly I'll have days back. It's also, you know, it allows us to do things like to travel and that kind of thing. And I love that this life and the flexibility has that we've set up for ourselves has allowed us to have this freedom of location as well. And that was another thing that was really important to us before we even had kids. And we sort of set that up, that we, this life up. So, you know, we aren't working at this capacity. We aren't earning the most money that we've ever earned, but we are rich in other ways. And that's what was really important to us. I guess we worked out really sort of at the end of that part of my career, what was going to be important to us for the future. And that happened to set us up for the life that we have now in, and this version of motherhood in a way that still feels good and that I really wanted for my kids and for me and my partner too.
Let's talk going from 1 to 2. You were in what seems like a pretty good rhythm. I'm sure it still had its challenges. We're not saying it was all easy and it worked perfectly, but you're in a good rhythm. You're both creative, so you could sort of share the load in that sense. When did you decide to add to your family and what was your experience like going from 1 to 2?
So again, I think I always wanted more than one if you know, if we were able to do it, and I'm 1 of 5. So I was like, yep, I definitely want more than one. And then I had this real thing that I wanted to get it all done by 40. I had to had it in my head that it had to be. So I sort of in a timeline was like, okay, well, if that's going to happen, you know, we sort of got to do it sort of soon. And so I fell pregnant with Miko, and we were still sort of, you know, we were doing the travel thing. But then it was like March of 2020 and all the lockdowns started to happen. And we were in America at the time and I was like weeks pregnant and we flew back to Australia straight into the first new quarantine thing. And I guess that pregnancy looked really different because, you know, with Yuki, we were traveling the world and I was very unstressed. I wasn't sitting at a desk every day. I was just working again when we around his schedule. And then, yeah, and then we came back into this really black time in Melbourne. And I really didn't want him to have that pregnancy to be like just like perpetual lockdowns and just grim life. So we actually went up to Northern New South Wales and hired an Airbnb for 3 months of that pregnancy in Cabarita Beach so that we could have some time. And it sounds really well, but we would just like get out of Melbourne, and we didn't even realize how bad Melbourne lockdowns would be or eventually be at the time. But I just also didn't want to have the stress and that energy of like this really scary, big, out of our control thing impacting my experience of being pregnant. So, yeah, so we went up there and spent 3 months in Cabarita. And I don't know, it was like COVID didn't exist up there. It was a different world to Melbourne. So, yeah, so we did that. And then we started to think about, okay, well, what would Melbourne look like for us when we sort of came back? And it was, yeah, it was really different. Like I was in the midwife program at the women's, and I was really excited to be part of it. It's such a good program, but most of the appointments were just done on the phone. And, you know, you weren't actually getting the sort of the care that you had signed up for. I think I had my first face-to-face when I was, I don't know, 32 weeks or 34 weeks. It was really late. And, you know, going into the hospital was really grim. Like, you know, no one was there. Everyone was still scared. Everyone was, you know, masked up and everything, obviously. And, you know, you were going to all the appointments alone. And, yeah, and so we actually decided at like 34 weeks that we were going to have a home birth. And we took ourselves out of the program and we got, it sounds really wild when I reiterate it, but we just decided that, you know, there was sort of too many moving parts and the experience at the hospital wouldn't feel the same. And so we went with a private midwife and we ended up having a home birth with Miko because, yeah, we just wanted to be again in our little bubble and to have a sort of nice birth experience. I also had no idea what we were going to, like if we had have gone down the traditional hospital path, what we were going to do with Yuki because our in-laws lived an hour away. They weren't in our bubble. And there was just, like I said, so many moving parts. You only had one person in the hospital. And I think having that stress of thinking about all of that happening at that time, I didn't want that again impacting the birth or the birth experience. So yeah, so that's the kind of, I know it's a really long lead up. So when all this was happening though, and I was still freelancing and we're up in Cabarita Beach, I just had been writing beauty still and features for different titles. And I get really creative when I'm pregnant. I don't know, I get really inspired. It must be something about growing human life. And I had this idea for essentially a beauty publication. I had written for websites and I could see what was happening with websites being that the only way that people were getting clicks were to promote on social media. And, you know, it was just this kind of vicious cycle of like having to keep this alive and then feeding that with this. And I was also feeling like there was nothing speaking to beauty in the way that I like to read it at the time, which is, you know, just like having a WhatsApp, like just like the group chat, basically. It's like every one of my group chats is filled with questions about, you know, different products or what everyone's using at the moment. And everyone always obviously comes to me to ask the same sort of thing. And I just wanted that really, I was wanting a, like an approachable community based something where there could be that two-way conversation and where beauty could be really accessible to everybody of every different sort of level and interest level, whether you're someone who doesn't wear makeup or someone who knows how to read an ingredient label already. I wanted us to sort of meet in the middle in this place. And so I sort of had been watching what was sort of happening overseas, and Substack had launched and was starting to gain a little bit of traction over in the States. And I was like, I think it's a beauty newsletter. I think that's what needs to happen here. And I was also, you know, a really time poor mom. I didn't have time to go onto websites. I didn't have time to listen to beauty podcasts, but I always checked my email. And I loved the idea that it wouldn't take away my time. It was something that I could choose to do. It wasn't another thing biting my time. It's, you know, it was there in the inbox. You could get it and read it whenever you had the time, delete it when you've read it, you know, click through and buy something if you wanted to. It was very designed around the fact that I wanted something sort of low touch. I wasn't asking for people's time or asking to refresh or click or like or blah, blah, blah. It was just there. So, yeah, so that's how Gloss Etc. was born. I rang up Shireen Youssef, who is the co-founder, and her and I have worked together at Marie Claire. We'd known each other since we started in Mags, and I basically bullied her into doing it with me. I'm like, I've got this great idea. And I was like, I only want to do it with you. We just work so well together. We're absolute yin and yang. You know, I have like this big sort of Labrador energy, and she's like a Siamese cat. She's very poised and organized, and we just have exact opposite skill sets. You know, she's very detail orientated and I'm very sort of big idea, but we come together in our writing. And you know, this to have the two voices in the newsletter as well is really great because we do speak differently.
You sound like Loz and I. That's identical to Loz and I. I'm you. Shireen's Loz.
You just have to have it. Like, you just, yeah. It makes sense. So, yeah. And so I just, and she loved the idea of, you know, having this community and that being ours and being able to speak to the audience directly and to have that interpersonal relationship. And we always talk about Gloss Etc. as being the group chat brought to life. And that's exactly what it is and still is to this day. So we sort of started working on that. And at the time I was like, I don't know, maybe 6 months pregnant. And we sort of started chatting about bringing that to life. And it just so happened, because this is how it always happens, that we ended up launching it a week before Miko was born, because I needed another child.
Always. Someone's either moving house or launching a business or something else happens the week before their baby is due.
Literally, I think we moved house 2 weeks before that. So it was like we moved house, I launched Glossies. It was just like I'm all or nothing. But honestly, it's also, we could do it because of Shireen. You know, I couldn't have absolutely done it on my own, and I didn't want to do it on my own. And I think that it needed, that it also needs the two voices. Like, it's very service journalism. We really want to listen to the audience and give back. And, you know, it's not all about what we want and what we like. It's definitely about what's going to be interesting to our readers and what do they need and how can we offer them value in their lives. Because, yeah, I feel like that, yeah, and that conversation was really sort of missing in beauty at the time. Yeah, so that's sort of how I birthed my third child.
Yeah. So what were the early days of launching Gloss and also launching Nico into the world like?
It was wild. You know, so that you asked about the transition from one to two. Honestly, that really shook me. I thought that one to two was much harder than zero to one. And it was mainly because I hadn't prepared for, we had prepared Yuki really well, but I hadn't prepared myself for how I would feel about the, like, it's like a loss of having the one, like, and having just that, my energy just on one person.
Yeah.
And then suddenly being divided. And I didn't realize how that would affect me emotionally to feel like I just wasn't doing anything very well. And that I wasn't giving him, he had all of my time and all of my energy, and suddenly I had to share it. And I wasn't really prepared because we had spoken to him at length about, you know, about having a sibling. I wasn't prepared for the emotions that he would even feel about that sort of, I guess, loss of my complete 100% attention as well.
Yeah.
So the first 8 weeks, honestly, were such a blur, and I really struggled. I really didn't know. I was a bit like, oh God, what have I done? And Bloss was the easiest baby in that because I knew what I was doing. Like, yeah. You know, writing is my thing. It's the thing that's come most naturally to me always. And I knew that I could just do it and get it out. And I had Shireen there to make sure that that it was all moving along smoothly. We have a creative director who's ex magazines who designs it. So like that side of thing was always very sort of easy, but the transition with Yuki and Miko was really, really hard.
Yeah.
And yeah, there was times where I was, you know, changing Miko's nappy and Yuki would be literally on top of me trying to like hang off my neck, and I couldn't even like physically do that. You know, when I was breastfeeding, he was there, and I just felt such immense guilt for that and for like destroying our bubble that we had. And yeah. And I just, the amount of, what are those tests called? The postnatal depression test, the amount of depression. I took like maybe 4 or 5 of them during that time, because every time I go to see the doctor, I'd like burst into tears, and they were like, do you want to just do this? And I wasn't postnatally depressed, but I was just overwhelmed.
Yes.
Completely 100% overwhelmed. And when I sort of worked out what we could do, I started to feel a bit better. So basically I said to Yuki, okay, well, we're going to have like an hour or two a week, and we're going to call it Mama and Yuki time, and it's just us, and we'll go and do something, just the two of us, and, you know, Dad can look after the baby. And we started to do that once a week, just the two of us, and he could look forward to that. And by like about week 8, I said to him one day, okay, what do you want to do? Oh, it's Mama and Yuki day. And he turned to me and he's like, oh, can Miko come? And I was like, oh my God. And it was like such a turning point, because, you know, I'd obviously filled his cup enough and
like reassured him or something. Yeah.
Yeah, reassured him that like he hadn't lost his place, and that, you know, I was still going to make time for him. And he genuinely just wanted to, you know, spend time with all of us then.
That makes me a bit like, I'm nearly crying. That makes me emotional.
It was so cute. It was so cute. And, yeah, and it was just, you know, I was so lucky that it sort of worked, but just putting aside that time really helped, yeah, reassure him. And I think it was just also good for me. Like, it really reassured me.
Actually, I'm a good mum. I really am. I'm doing my best.
And, you know, I haven't lost this connection because I've got another one. So yeah, it was messy and chaotic. And I barely remember the first 8 weeks, but that was a returning point for when things became a little bit more manageable, I reckon.
I'm interested in now learning about 2 phases of yours and your heart and your partner's juggle, for lack of a better word. I sort of hate that word, but we'll just stick with it. I'm interested firstly in Nico and Yuki's sort of toddler years. Obviously Yuki would have been a bit older. I'm interested to know how you navigated it all then and how your week sort of looked. And then also the transition of Yuki starting school. Then did that free up much extra time, or is it that you still have another child at home, so it doesn't really free up as much time as we think? How did that all go?
It's that thing, like I said, I think that I sort of set myself up for flexibility in that way, unknowingly, sort of early on. Like, I, first of all, that sort of, to backtrack, like coming out of a sort of a career job at the time, all of that, you know, that loss, that like the sort of the loss of self and the ego and everything that like you commonly really experience in motherhood, when you're just like, when you're not your version of your past self a lot.
Yeah.
I unknowingly had done that by stepping out of my career 2 years before I even had kids.
Yeah, it was like another type of identity in postpartum.
I had a full, like, you know, identity crisis meltdown. And for about 6 months when we first started traveling, I was just an absolute, like, who am I? What am I doing? And so, yeah, so I kind of had that complete unraveling without a kid. while I was traveling the world and, you know, you're wondering who I am without my job title, because they were so linked. I was always Sarah from Cosmo, Sarah from Girlfriend. They were one and the same. It was me and the brand that I worked for, one and the same. And suddenly I was just Sarah and I didn't really know what to do with that. So all of that kind of played into the fact that I kind of then, when I had kids, I didn't feel at such a loss anymore, because I'd already dealt with that sort of identity part of myself and my career beforehand. So I got to just deal with the evolutions of motherhood, just deal with it. That little thing, instead of having to deal with what that looked like with sort of the grief of losing your career self. Yeah. So in that way, I was really lucky. And like I said, it kind of did set me up for this flexibility, so that we were really agile as a team. My partner and I were really agile as a team to move with whatever came our way. And one of us is always really flexible. We decided on Melbourne as the place that we would settle, because Phil's family live here and, you know, we have family support, and his parents are incredible with helping out with the boys. And so one day a week she has always taken one of them. So yeah. When Mako was a baby, she would take Yuki so that we would also have time with just Mako to bond with him. And that was incredible. And it also meant that as a grandparent, she got to bond with her grandchildren one-to-one, which, you know, and that is such a huge gift to be able to do. So that was one part of the picture. But also, we're really lucky in that I think when Mako stopped being just a lump and started being a bit more fun, they hung out together. So it's in some ways it got easier.
Yes. I'm noticing that now, actually. Posey and Ray are starting to play with each other, and I don't feel guilty about not always being present. I can sort of sit at the dining table with the laptop open, not all the time, but sometimes it's working.
So as he got a bit older, it was like that 2 years was just like, okay, you're really in it. But when they started to be able to interact more, they are together in their room. And like, I mean, they're breaking up fights and, you know, and whatever all the time, like, obviously.
It's not gorgeous from 9 to 5 and you just hop in at the end of the day and sit
there. Yeah, just like, oh, they're just in their room. Like,
they've fed themselves, cleaned up.
I'm in there a lot. But it is easier, because when it was just one, they, like, you needed our attention all the time. It was like, look at me. Oh, and blah, blah, blah. And there was a lot of that, but now they have each other to sort of satisfy that part of it. So it did get sort of easier. And then we would just tag team time. Like, honestly, our schedules are flexible. It was like whoever had the earliest deadline was the one that got the priority.
And is it almost like hour to hour? Like, is it, I've got this on Monday at 12. Are you around? And then the other partner's like, yep, I am. I will block that out.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's totally that. It's just sort of like time negotiation. Like, a lot of the job that I do now with Gloss, etc., a huge part of my job is going to events and, you know, meeting with clients. And so, but all of that stuff I know well in advance. So it's written in my diary. We look at my diary in the week. I have more of that type of thing. And then we work out timelines between the two of us, like who's there, whatever, and reschedule anything that sort of needs to be rescheduled. But also, you know, I will take Mako a lot. Like, now that Yuki's in school, yes, they did free up a lot of time. And then Mako is at kinder 2 days a week. But, you know, we all know that the days are still end up being quite short. One thing I will say is that I think that mothers are really productive. And I now think, wow, what did I do with 8 hours a day of work? What was I doing at my desk?
Yeah, and I always wonder what I did from like 5 to 8 p.m. Like, what did I do? I took it for granted. I know that.
Absolutely. I can't, like, if I had 8 hours of work now, just what I could do with that time. I'm not quite sure what I did with the time then, but I just think mothers are great with being super productive. Like, give me an hour and I will get it done. And that's something, you know, that I didn't realize until I became a mother, that we're just so good at just grabbing those tiny bits of time and making the absolute most of them, that actually I'm more productive than, I'm sure, you know, most people that have endless hours in a day to do the work, because I really am on a time limit and I love a deadline because I'm a journalist. Yeah. So we just kind of, you know, we just barter time between us basically. But yeah. I also take Miko with me. Like, he, you know, he has come to events, he's come to meetings, and he's just used to being a bit of a plus one now. And I think I always ask, obviously, beforehand if it's okay to bring him, but we're at a time now where it should be okay a lot of the time. To, it's a reality of the world we live in, that we, and of motherhood, that I am going to, you know, have to be a mum. And so
I'm not hiding it as much.
No, I'm not hiding it. And I'm kind of, you know, it's like unapologetic about it. It's not like, oh, I'm really sorry, I have, you know, Miko today. I'm just like, you know, this is a Miko day, can I bring him along? And if it's a no, which it actually hasn't been ever, but if it was a no, that's fine, then I just can't do it. And that's like, I just think that I've also gotten to a point where I'm just like, I'm not going to, apologize for being a mother.
It's such a good point. I always apologize for that. And I have not even put those things together until now, that you're literally apologizing for having children, which makes no sense.
Yeah, they can, you know, and I think I've always just folded my kids into my life. So it's just a natural progression of that as well. And, you know, it's like, honestly, it's fine. They're used to it now. Like, my kids are used to being my plus one. But it's also just, yeah, I just think it's a sort of reality. And, you know, it's the same in, you know, sending emails. I used to be very like, I will only send emails at, like, no one wants to get an email at like 10 o'clock at night, but no one's checking their emails, or they shouldn't be checking their emails at 10 at night. That's my work time. So I'll send emails out and that will be in their inbox. And I do not expect a reply, but I'm also like, I'm also not going to be embarrassed that I'm sending an email at 10 p.m. at night, because that is my work time. That's what works for me. And that's just sort of how it is.
And that's how it is. I totally agree with you. I'm going to take away to be less apologetic. I'm interested to know, for anyone that wants to start a business alongside motherhood, I believe that Gloss is still a free newsletter. I'm interested to know how you monetize. I'm assuming you make content for others too, given your background. Hmm. How does it work?
So from the beginning, and again, this is coming from our background of being in media, and we, you know, we worked for magazines, which you have to pay for that content. I guess I had a firsthand seat in seeing the decline in paying for content, especially sort of with the younger generation who have always gotten it for free. So I just think it's a really hard ask to ask people to pay for content now when everything is at your fingertips. Like, how do you add enough value to get people to part with money? So that's one part of it. And the other part of it was that we wanted it to be free because we wanted it to be accessible. And the goal was always just to get it into the hands of, you know, as many people as possible, and to make them feel welcome. And putting some sort of paywall on it would sort of work against that. So we made the decision early on that it was going to be free, and that we would monetize through advertising. And so, but one of the things that we didn't love about working in traditional media was that we were really beholden to advertisers. And with that meant that we would often have to cover products that we hadn't tried, that we were just sort of told, well, they're spending X amount of money, so you have to write this story. And regardless of our personal feelings about the product or the brand or whatever, we just had to do it. So we also made a rule very early on that everything that we cover in the newsletter was something that we would have personally tried and tested ourselves, or if it's not our skin type or our hair type or whatever, it goes to a small group of our, et cetera, our family and our friends and that kind of thing, that will trial it for us and report back. So, and that goes hand in hand with how we work with advertisers. No advertiser that we take on should ever come as a surprise to our audience, because we would have talked about it before. We would have talked about the brand. And if it doesn't align, we just politely decline. And or if we take it on, it's always with the caveat that we have to trial it first. And if it doesn't work, yeah, we just won't do it. So, I mean, that's the great thing about being your own boss.
Yes. So next year, Miko starts school as well. What's that going to mean for you with making work work alongside motherhood? I mean, we won't paint an unrealistic picture because the school day does go quickly, as we know. But still, I guess for the first time, there'll be 5 days of formatted care and the exact same care for both kids, I imagine.
Yeah.
What does that mean for you? And how are you feeling, I guess, both from the emotional side of it and also the positive, exciting side of it?
Oh my God, I feel really emotional about him starting school, to be honest. It's like a real chapter of little kids that has closed. So, you know, at the moment he's in kinder 2 days a week. So I'm trying to sort of maximize the time that we have together. Yeah, I get really sad about the year. Like I'm so excited for him, but it is a real transition.
I will be right there with you and it's my turn. I've already got goosebumps thinking about it.
I know. I just feels like that played into the decision as well with daycare is that I'm like 5 years goes by in a heartbeat and I just really wanted that time with them, with both of them. And then once you'd given it to Yuki, we also definitely wanted to give it to Miko as well. And it just goes so fast. Like I can't believe that we're almost there already and we're not going to get the time back in. Then you lose them as, you know, you start to lose them to their friends and they're, you know, they don't want to hang out with you as much. And so I just really want to sort of hold on to this time as much as we can. But on the flip side, yeah, it means that hopefully the 7 to 9 work time won't be existing anymore and it will be more daytime work and that, you know, which means that, yeah, I can sort of get my nights back, which is a really exciting thought.
This is more of a selfish question, but I think a lot of our listeners would be similar to me. I said to you before we started recording that I'm not a beauty or makeup person. I care a little bit. I just have no idea. What are some really simple products or even just the types of products that you think are best for busy mums that are just trying to put on a bit of a face to get into the office or to get out for drinks with the girls or whatever it is? What do you gravitate towards and what do you think are the easiest little wins that don't take too much time and that you don't have to be experienced in using?
Yeah, well, I think that you need to spend the time with the skincare, first of all, because your skin, you need less makeup when your skin is looking good, basically.
Okay. What's your favorite skincare at the moment? Let's quickly stay on that.
How long do you have? No, you know, honestly, it's a basic routine. You have to cleanse at nighttime to get off everything from the day and then just choose a serum. The serum is where you spend your money because it does the hardest work. So again, it depends on what your skin type is. But I think a lot of, especially new mums, like are very dehydrated with all the hormones and stuff. So getting a hydrating serum is always really good. I use a retinol at nighttime and I use it with a hydrating serum. And then just, you can use a cheap cleanser, use a cheap moisturizer, spend your money on the serum. That's where it's at. So like, you know, honestly, get a chemist cleanser, get a gentle chemist cleanser, get a CeraVe or a Cetaphil or whatever moisturizer. It doesn't really matter, but yeah, spend your money on the serum. And then a vitamin C in the morning is non-negotiable for me and sunscreen, of course. So, you know, that's kind of like a really, what I would do say is really basic. But if you're tired and, you know, like we all are, who's not tired?
Like, what does it mean not to be tired?
Yeah. What does that look like for you? I'm not sure. What does not tired look like? I'll get back to you in 10 years when my kids start sleeping through the night. I think that, yeah, so if you have your skincare sorted and it's like, and that's looking good, then yeah, you don't need to wear that much. I actually think that wearing more makeup actually does the opposite of what you think it's doing in that it makes you look like you're trying to hide something and make you sort of look more tired, more worse. So I actually love like a skin tint or a tinted moisturizer with some illuminator. There's Mecca Cosmetica. I have a really great one that I love. That's called, I think it's is called In Good Light. And I just do like a half a squirt of that and half a squirt of like a tinted moisturizer or of a skin tint. And it's literally just like a very sheer coverage, but because it's glowy.
Yeah, you do. I'm looking at me. I can see me, and I've put some moisture or foundation on that has too much like glow in it or whatever. I don't even know my words. Right. See, I'm so not makeup-y. But you look so nice and sheer, and I'm like, I'm going straight to the shops after this chat.
It's just so, and it is the most sheer coverage, and then like, and a bit of concealer, and that will, I honestly, that'll do it. And there's like other things that like, that's like a 5-minute face, like a bit of that at like a mascara is like a 5-minute face. But then it's the other things, like there are things that I have that make me feel done, like having groomed brows, for example. Yes. Like I dye my own eyebrows, but because they're so really thin. So I just, yeah, so but as long as they're groomed and that, and for me having like my neck, like having nice nails, they're the two things that make me feel like I've got my life together.
I love that. And do you have anything on your cheeks? I'm really turning this into a beauty tutorial.
Yes, I do have something on my cheeks. What is it? It is the brand Merit. They're all about like 5-minute beauty, so it's a Merit blush.
Oh, it looks great.
Yeah, thank you.
You've just got like the perfect getting out the door, I'm a mum going to work vibe. You've got it sorted. So I feel like the people.
Not my 5-minute routine, honestly. And I use my fingers. It's like there is not a science to it. I use my fingers. The other thing that I do is go in with concealer first.
Is that what you put just under your eyes?
Just like if you go in with concealer first, and I always, so I use the concealer, I put the concealer on my hand and then I sort of buff it in with a brush and then I put it on. But if you do the concealer, and I do it sort of in the red spots that are new, so under the eyes, but also sort of around the nose and stuff. If you go in with that first, then you can see how little coverage you need on the rest of your face. Whereas if you go in after, you're actually putting more on, like you might find after you've put on the concealer that actually I don't need any foundation at all, because that's given enough, that's taken away enough of, you know, the redness or the things that you wanted to cover that you don't need anything else. So then, and I also just think that the older, I know that the older we get, actually the better we look with less makeup. That's just
No makeup, makeup. That's good for mums too, because we don't have much time. I took this on a really beauty-related tangent towards the end there, but if people are finding us via you, they care about that stuff. So I'll stick with that. But my last question is, if you could go back to new mum Sarah and tell her one thing or give her one piece of advice, what would it be?
I think that I waited, like I said, I waited for such a long time because I kept feeling like I wasn't ready. And I don't think any mum is ready for it. I just, because you can't know until you're in it, you can't explain to somebody what it feels like to be a mother unless you're in it. And I think I would tell her that everything really is a season, and that if I could step out of my head a little bit more and just enjoy those parts of where I was at when I'm in it, because it goes really quickly. And I think also that I would enjoy it more than I thought it was going to as well. Like I actually really love being a mum, and I do a lot with my kids. You know, we talked about how much I travel with the kids. And I think that was a really conscious decision as well, that my partner Phil and I think it's probably an knee-jerk to sort of what our parents were doing, and, you know, everyone was having kids early and then waiting for them to grow up so that they could retire or go and live their lives or go on that big trip that they wanted to go on. And we have consciously decided to live our life now with the kids involved and a part of our life. We're not kind of waiting for another 15 years for them to move out of home so that we can kind of do our life. They're very much a part of our life and our every sort of our everyday. And I love that. Like I love hanging out with my kids. They're awesome. And I think maybe I would tell myself that I would love this job more than any other job that I would ever have. And I think that would surprise early 30s Sarah, who was striving sort of for a career pinnacle, but that, you know, this version of life, like I said, is smaller than it was. It certainly doesn't have the pay packet of what I used to earn, but I have so much more, and in the time and the flexibility and this time that I can have with my kids that I wouldn't have had. So I feel like, I know that sounds like such a cliche, but it does feel so rich. It's like it's in so many other ways. And I think that this version of my life is not something that I could have imagined that I would have been, I would have had or been so happy with. Yeah.
What a beautiful sentiment to end with. If people want to find you or Gloss, et cetera, online, where should they go?
Well, they can subscribe to the newsletter at www.glossetc.co, and they can find us on Instagram at gloss.etc.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Ready or Not. If you liked the show, please tell your friends, subscribe, or write a review. You can also find us on Instagram at readyornot.pod. That's it for today. We'll see you next time.